You're listening to a short, free clip from the full episode of this members-only episode of the Seventh Row podcast. Most episodes of our podcast are members-only, but we're providing you this little preview of the full episode so you can get a taste of what membership would give you. As well as getting access to our podcast archive, you'll also get all the content that we produce for our podcast feed, covering new releases and beyond. On this episode, myself, Laura Smith, and my co-host Alex Heaney sat down to discuss everything that we've been watching lately at film festivals and what patterns we've been surveying in the film landscape. This episode will take a look at films from the Toronto International Film Festival, or TIFF, and the London Film Festival, or LFF, as well as other smaller festivals. What you're listening to now is a short free clip from the full episode. To listen to the whole thing, as well as all our other podcast content, become a member at 7th-row.com/join and enjoy a whole host of other perks.
So on today's episode, we're going to be talking about the fall festival circuit, fall films, and how they relate to what screened earlier in the year. I am Alex Heaney, editor-in-chief of 7th Row, and I'm joined by my co-host, Orla Smith, executive editor of 7th Row. So what festivals between us have we attended?
You more than me. I've just wrapped up the London Film Festival, which is one of those sort of TIFF-like amalgamations of the programming of other festivals throughout the year and previews of things that will win Oscars.
TIFF doesn't really amalgamate anymore. They just play Cannes titles.
And you went to TIFF, but you've been to a few smaller film festival offerings as well.
Yeah, I did TIFF, and then I also did like Festival du Nouveau Cinéma, which is kind of like the new festival of festivals of Canada, which has overlap but also plays more like Berlin film festival stuff and avant-garde stuff. I did the Vancouver International Film Festival. I'm in the middle of Imaginative right now, which is the Indigenous Film Festival. And then, like, earlier in the year, we both did Sundance and Berlin. Mm-hmm. And then you did a little Cannes. I did a bit more Cannes.
A little Cannes, just a dash.
And we did a little Hot Docs and a little Vision du Réal. And I guess I sort of did a little Venice, but a lot of the Venice stuff I saw was also at TIFF. I was chasing after the Orizzonte section where they often have films that are good that no one else screens and disappear, like last year's Full Time and also like Mikhail Hare's Amanda. Mm-hmm. So I was looking for those equivalents. I didn't find any. they're mostly bad.
So this episode will just be a kind of like brain dump of the things we've noticed and the films and patterns that have caught our attention as we've been wading through all these films. We won't be talking specifically about women talking because we have an episode coming up about that film. And we talk a bit about She Said in that episode as well. So we're going to kind of, you know, not spend a lot of time on those. We weren't fans. The Eternal Daughter is a film we both really loved, but we're not gonna harp on it too much because we also have an episode coming out about that.
And because we are the Joanna Hogg world experts, yes, having written the book on her, so we wanted to do a proper episode where we talk about it as the now third entry in the what is now the Julie Hart trilogy. That we thought, yes, was a duology with The Souvenir 1 and 2, but no, it's trilogy now.
Julie Returns! and we also really liked a Cannes competition title that has been doing the full festival circuit, Io. It's a Polish film about a donkey living his life. Mm-hmm. And
trying to live his life amidst so much injustice.
Yes, so we'll be talking about that on the podcast in our next episode. So
we should say we loved Eternal Daughter and Io, like we really, yeah, liked those films, so that's why there's going to be an episode and we really had issues with women talking.
Yes.
Which is why we cannot get into them in 5 minutes. It took us like an hour plus. So
yes, We only do podcast episodes if we have very strong feelings either way. And we very much do with these films.
Yeah. Okay, so I think we wanted to start with, like, some of our big favorites.
That... wanted to start with some positivity.
Yeah, and also because a lot of these don't have distribution or won't be out for a while. So we'll probably do some of these will probably get their own episodes, but that may be a while because we don't want to do it, like, when none of you can see them.
Mm-hmm.
Because that seems mean.
But there's one film in particular, because there's not as much overlap in what we've seen as there usually is. But one film that we both saw that was at Venice and then TIFF.
Yeah.
That we, I mean, it might, it's definitely up there.
Was it at LFF too?
No.
Okay.
It was a complete Frederick Wiseman ban at LFF. His new film he directed was not there. And the film he starred in was not there.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on with why his film didn't screen anywhere except New York. I haven't
seen it. His films always screen at LFF.
And his films always screen at TIFF. I haven't seen Coupla yet, so maybe it's bad or something. But that seems unlikely.
There were plenty of people who didn't like it, but I also don't necessarily trust 100% those Venice reactions. But yeah, so he is in a film as an actor.
And he met, because I interviewed Rebecca Zlotowski, which will be out at some point in the nearest future. And they met at Venice when they were both screening films there. And they had a discussion about director's shoes, because she said she liked his sneakers. And he was like, these are director's shoes. And he said he likes her fancy shoes because she was in heels or something, and she said these are also director's shoes. And then they bonded, and then
they both live in Paris as well.
Yeah, and he was in everyone else's movie, and she was like, why aren't you in my movie, Fred? So
and he plays Virginia Fira's gynecologist.
Yes.
And by the way, the film is called Other People's Children.
Yeah, sorry. There's more to this film than Frederick Wiseman.
He's only in two scenes, but they are two wonderful scenes.
Yeah, it's one of those, like, best cameo for sure performances.
Yeah, he's a very warm and comforting presence as her gynecologist.
Yeah. But yeah, so it's about other people. It's called Other People's Children.
It's about other people's children.
It is about other people's children. It's kind of in that lineage of films about women with a thousand things going on in their lives in the midst of a bit of an existential crisis. Mm-hmm. Like, I think it's a really great double feature with Spinster, but it's also of a piece with kind of like Mia Hansen Love's films and even Alice Winokur's films in a way, like Proxima, more so than Paris Memories, her new one. But...
Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like, it's about a woman who, again, like you said, has a thousand things going on in her life. And one of the sort of dramatic crux, well, the dramatic crux of the film is set off by Frederick Wiseman when he tells her that she has, you know, if she wants to have children, she should try for them now because biologically she may not be able to within the next year. So our main character, played by Virginia Fira, is also in a relationship with a man who has a child, and she becomes a child stepmother, and she's toying with this idea of motherhood and whether, like, biological motherhood is really important to her. She's also a teacher, and so part of her life is nurturing children. And so there's this question of, like, I'm already nurturing children. Do I need to have a child, quote-unquote, of my own? And I think the film just... deals with that conflict and that inner dialogue in a way, and it's not something that's necessarily depicted on screen a ton, and it deals with it so sensitively and in such a nuanced way that I just adored.
Mm-hmm.
And I love this, like, conversation she has in the film at one point. I can't remember the exact dialogue because it's been a few weeks since I saw the film, where she's talking about, like, how she has this desire to be a mother, but she also feels some pride of, like, being part of the club of women who don't have children.
Mm-hmm.
And it really understands every side of that conversation that a person has with themselves.
Mm-hmm. Including the fact that she had a couple of abortions and doesn't regret those, even though now she seems to think she really wants a biological child and can't have one. So it's really nuanced about that.
Yeah, and the film is not at all prescriptive about, like, whether there's one way for this character to be happy. I think if there was, like, an easy way for her to have, like, a biological child in that moment and it made sense, she would. But also it asks, can she still be happy and fulfilled without that, even if it's something that she might want?
Yeah, I mean, it sets up all these different threads of potential opportunities for caring in her life. Like, mm-hmm. as you said, she's a teacher and she has this little subplot where she's really making a difference in one of her students' lives. Partway through the film, her sister gets pregnant. So there's going to be an opportunity for her to be an aunt. But, like, the main action kind of centers around or begins with she starts this relationship with a man who has a young daughter. And they rush into it, and she makes a lot of rash and ill-advised decisions, which I think are probably partly because she likes the child even more than she likes the guy. Mm-hmm. And she really wants to be a mother, and that seems to be what she thinks is her path. And, like, to the point that even they have unprotected sex, and she's kind of like, that was kind of dumb, but also I kind of want a sperm donor maybe, so. And then it takes her a while, though I think the film shows that she has all these plates in the air before she comes to that realization that there are many ways to have a caring role to other people's children. That doesn't necessarily mean being their step-parent. And that even being their step-parent for the guy she's dating, the mother is still alive and still has a relationship with the kid and they have joint custody. She's always going to be on the outside because there are already the kid's parents to be joint parenting. And it's so new in the relationship. I mean, whatever. There's a lot of complicated things about whether or not she deserves to be brought in at this stage as more of a parenting role. But she certainly isn't. And it's unclear whether that would change in future had other things happened. But there is something about how it's not that you can't, that you have to be a biological mom. But when you're a stepmom, like, it's just not the same as being the primary caregiver.
And there's a strange dynamic of, like, if you break up with this person, then is the child just out of your life, even if you feel, like, a motherly sense towards them? Which
yeah.
is also a dynamic that, like, I sort of haven't thought to think about a ton because yeah. it's not really talked about.
It's a lovely film. The costumes are amazing. I covet everything Virginie Efira wears.
And it's just like you said, it does such an amazing job of just, like, creating a character who has, like, 20 things in her life. And, you know, the film doesn't feel overwhelmed with them. It just feels like she's a real person. And I feel like Spinster is another film that is amazing at that, which you mentioned yeah. as, like, a good film in conversation with this. And I think it is such a difficult thing to do, and so few films do it as well as this one.
Yeah.
Like, she really just feels like a whole person in a way that, like, movie characters rarely do, but real people in your life often do.
Yeah, I think Mia Hansen-Love has always been very good at this, like, in Things to Come and Bergman Island, which we have an earlier episode on. And even in her new film, One Fine Morning, which I have issues with. But I've been thinking about this a lot. I think one of the reasons that films do this, and films about women do this, is if you don't show women have 10 things going on, then you assume they have nothing going on. Whereas men, you meet their wives once and you're like, oh, they have a family. Mm-hmm. You know, and then also men usually don't have caring roles where they're caring for their aging parent and for their kids. They're just sort of like, oh, my kids are around and then I leave and then someone else cares for them.
One thing I really liked about The Eternal Daughter is it does something that, like, I've rarely ever seen except for maybe in Joanna Hogg's film,
yes.
which is you have this main character who you're following, and then, like, maybe 2/3 of the way in, it's mentioned that she has a husband back home. But, like, other than that, he is, like, not at all particularly important. But he's just, like, a part of her life that we understand is there. And, she's a full character and her life doesn't revolve around him in the way that often men's wives are depicted. And we kind of take that as assumed.
Yeah. It's an interesting new grammar, I think, for stories about women, is that you can't really tell their stories without showing the 10 things going on in their lives. Like Run Woman Run does that too.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't really have to do that for men, partly because things are assumed and also partly because they probably don't have 10 things going on.
Mm-hmm. Women are multitaskers.
Yeah, well, and they generally hold a lot of the caring roles, so that's already like half the plates.
Yeah, I mean, women are enforced multitaskers.
Yes. Enforced by patriarchy.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm hoping we'll do an episode on that. In the meantime, I'm in the process of translating my interview with Virginie Efira, which we did in French. Hopefully, I have a big interview with Rebecca Zlotowski, which we might expand a bit more before we publish it on the film. So those will be out sooner, I think. And then hopefully this film will get picked up because it doesn't have distribution anywhere outside of France that I'm aware mm-hmm. of. I mean, maybe in some other European countries, but not the UK or North America. And I don't know why. It's like a crowd pleaser.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say, you know, it may be the best film I've seen to premiere this year. Yeah. I really loved it. It's got a few films to contend against, but like, I don't think I've loved anything more than I have this film.
Yeah,
I think it's really wonderful. And I think Rebecca Zlotowski is such an underrated filmmaker, often because like she talks about things in her films in such nuanced ways that people often don't appreciate the way that she's exploring her themes. And this film, it because of its sort of warmth and like moments of comedy, has been received in a bit more of a warm way, although still I think it should have been hyped up as much as all the other films at Venice, like The Whale. Why do we need to talk about The Whale when we could be talking about other people's children?
Right? And can we talk about something other than that people think other people's children is Worst Person in the World Part 2, which it is absolutely not.
But yeah, I mean, we'd also recommend An Easy Girl, which we did a podcast episode on. It's on Netflix, and that is a film that I think went really misunderstood.
Yeah.
And even by us. We watched it, because I think her films really flourish on rewatch, because they are so rich and so dense, and we only really realized what she was doing with An Easy Girl the second time we watched it.
Yeah. She plays with, I think, expectations. It's like something we talked about with, I think, went on our podcast on childhood sexual assault. I think that's what we talked about this with Lena, about how we don't know how to talk like how to read women's stories because it's such a new concept.
Yes, yeah.
And I think that's true because when you rewatch An Easy Girl, once you know where it goes, and when you rewatch Other People's Children, once you know where it goes, in the first 5 minutes she tells you what it's about. It's just that when you watch it the first time, you don't know what you haven't figured out what that is yet. You're just kind of like, there's a lot of information and I don't know what, you know, in An Easy Girl, I don't know what choosing my career path has to do with this plastic surgery 20-something-year-old bathing topless.
And what a joy, really, because I think a lot of the most boring films at film festivals are ones that kind of state their purpose completely up front and then don't surprise you.
Yeah.
They're not the worst films, but they are the majority of what you see. And it's just so much less interesting than a film that reveals itself to you in the way that her films do.
That was the end of this excerpt from our episode on the 2022 Fall Festivals. The full Members Only episode goes on for over 60 more minutes. In it, we dig into more of the films we loved and hated, how these festivals have got us thinking about our respective national cinemas, and the pitfalls of praising first features in the festival circuit. To listen to the episode, become a member at 7th-row.com/join. You'll get to listen to our entire podcast archive, gain a host for the perks, and support our work while you do it.